I am with not one Alex, but two Alexes, and we are going to get some incredible analysis on what's going on in the world right now.
NordVPN is becoming more than just a VPN. Threat protection will guard your device against malicious websites, malware, trackers, and intrusive ads, even if you're not connected to a VPN server at the time. Step up your cybersecurity and stay safe.
I invested £25,000. Today, that investment is worth £5 million.
Say hello to our hero, the Hydrogen Energy Release Optimizer. Limitless power, zero emissions.
Hi everybody, it's Crypto Rich, and I am with Alex Craner and Alex Cristoforo. This video has been a long, long time coming because you can't have too many Alexes. Not of this caliber anyway. Now, before I introduce them, please subscribe, follow me on Twitter, CryptoRichYT, join my official Telegram announcements channel. And if you're watching this on YouTube, I may not post the whole thing on YouTube. So you've got to come over to either Threespeak or Odyssey, and the links are right above there. Okay, Alex Cristoforo from the Duran. I'll have all the links in the description below. The incredible analysis that you and your partner, Alexander Mercuris, do. And I know Alexander is incredibly busy, incredibly, incredibly busy. And I know you're busy for different reasons. And Alex Craner, thank you. And your Naked Hedgie. And I'll have all the links in the description below so people can find your work. Okay, now, Alex Craner, it has been a very, very quiet Christmas. We're recording this on the December the 27th. There's been absolutely nothing going on. And I'm just like, well, 2024 is going to be so dull and boring. I'm sure of it. Is there, what do you want to start off with?
Well, first of all, you know, I think that the world's slowly coming apart, but I always think of it in terms of that Confucian maxim that when a large tree falls, it falls with great noise and destruction. But seeds grow in silence. And I think that we're living this every day as we see old, obsolete structures of society and old, obsolete security arrangements and security architecture in the world are coming apart. It's looking awful in many places. The people who are in charge of whatever is left of the Western power structure are doing everything to preserve that power structure, but I think that the tide has turned against them in such strength that it's a veritable tsunami that's hitting them. And so one gets lost in the news. It's become almost impossible to keep track of everything that's going on in, you know, in the Red Sea, in Palestine, in Israel, in Serbia, in all the rest of Europe, in the United States, China, you know, you name it, everywhere it's cracking apart. I try to make sense of it by keeping it all in context. And I think that the broadest possible context that this can be analyzed under is that we are observing a clash between two systems of governance. We have the collapsing Western imperial colonial system of government, of governance. And then we have the whole rest of humanity emerging in ways that they knew was coming. You know, like when you read old documents from these think tanks in the Western world, you see that they anticipated this as early as 1960s. At the very least. And you see that the remedies that they came up with have now all failed. And the new world that is emerging is not just Russia and China and the countries that are joining their BRICS movement, but it's even the Western nations. We see that in the emergence of quote-unquote populism and quote-unquote far right around the world. But this is basically people just airing their grievances and searching for a, for alternatives, for a new architecture, for a new way of organizing society. And so I think one of the most interesting zones in this respect is Europe, because Europe is stuck in an ossified system that has been replaced with a horribly misbegotten European Union, which now we see cracking apart. Last summer, when we had those riots in France, I realized that France is very close to breaking ranks with Europe. And when I say very close, I don't mean, you know, next month, next week, but I mean, in historical terms, we could be, you know, a year or a few years away from this. And why do I say that? Because France has been losing their colonial possessions, or, you know, the countries over which it exercised colonial power in Africa. The riots that happened last summer in early July, I believe, I'm convinced that that was orchestrated by the Anglo-American elites to warn Macron not to break ranks, not to stray to the wrong side, because Macron has been giving all the wrong signals about needing to patch the bridge with Russia, to the need to take into account Russian security concerns. He was among the statesmen, the one that he was spent probably the most time talking to Vladimir Putin, and so on and so forth. And so, you know, the French ruling establishment got a stark warning. And then the riots just went away from one day to the next. And they invented that stupid story that it was the drug dealers who stopped the riots. A story which was such an insult to anybody's intelligence that it doesn't even merit discussion. But now, among the latest news, we see that Vladimir Putin has been voicing his openness to reopen the relationship with Macron, to, you know, to talk to him again. And Macron amazingly said, well, my telephone number hasn't changed. So this is imminent. They're going to start talking again. And, you know...
Alex, hold on, right?
Yes.
Because I do want to give Alex Christoforou an opportunity. And I think talking about France and Russia and the US and the UK is a really good entry point. At least I think so, Alex. Because one of the things that I think is great about both of you, how you do this separately and independently of each other, this first time you're together, is teasing out what's going on in the background. And how that might shape up. Anything you want to comment on, Alex, about this, in particular about the situation in France?
The situation in France, yeah. So Putin was asked about Macron in France during his Q&A, and I think Putin gave a very Putin-like response, a very statesman-like response that we come to expect from Putin. Which is essentially that, you know, I'm open to discuss with Macron. You know, we're always, as Russia, he says, we're always open to dialogue. But now when Putin speaks about having dialogue with say France or Macron or anyone in the collective West, he's very particular to say, but we are going to look after our interests. He'll say we're open to speak with our partners, but he'll always say, but everything has to be discussed with our interests in mind, and we're going to pursue our interests. In the past, he wouldn't say that. Now he says it with just about every statement with regards to opening up some sort of a dialogue or some sort of a discussion with the West. But you know, the team around Putin, they've pretty much shut the door on Europe. And with each passing week that goes by, you can see that Putin's stance is also hardening with Europe. Now, I agree with Alex. If there's one country that could open up dialogue with Russia, it's France in the EU. The question is if Macron is the person to do it.
Yes.
I mean, Macron, I personally don't have a very high opinion of Macron, but he is the one European leader who every now and then gets it right. His problem is that he's a coward. and he can't follow up on what he says. He always backs down. So when he says, I want to open up dialogue with Russia, the next day he comes back and he says, no, Russia's a pariah state and we can't talk to them. And we're gonna give Ukraine another 10 tanks or something like that. I mean, he does the same thing with China. He went to see Xi Jinping. They had productive discussions. He said, France and China, rapprochement, everything is good. We're going to be working with China. And then 24 hours later, you know, she's a dictator. Macron can never follow through on what he says, which is an indication. I think what Alex said is important because I think it's an indication that the West, they have Macron's number. They know how to scare Macron. They know how to get him to back down. They know how to get him to change course, even though there's a part of Macron that understands that if France doesn't start aligning itself with the East, the Global South, the BRICS, call it whatever you want, he understands that if he doesn't do that, then France is in big trouble. There's a part of Macron that understands that the collective West ship is sinking. He just doesn't have the courage to follow through on it, which opens up the question, is there a leader in France that will have the courage? And would that leader be allowed to become president?
Alex Krainer?
Well, I very much share Alex's dislike for Macron. You know, I've always I can barely tolerate the man, honestly. However, you know, he is where he is, and he does represent. You know, the problem with him, why he comes across as a spineless coward, is because he's not a sovereign ruler of France. He's a puppet on a string.
Yeah.
But I think that the people who, let's say, handle Macron, which is, you know, the French, the old French elites, the owner class, let's say, they understand that they got massively, massively shafted by the, you know, the London, New York axis, the Anglo-American elites, and that they treat them with utter contempt. And so what's special about France? I think that France, among the Western European nations, scores the lowest on the Russophobia continuum. I think that there's a very...
Lower than Italy?
Sorry?
Lower than Italy?
Well, I don't know. I would say that there's definitely an affinity for Russia in France. Even within 2 weeks... So this poll was published 2 weeks after the beginning of the special military operation in February 22. But so the poll was done some days sooner. But, you know, the French government ran a poll among the French people, asking them about you know, how they felt about Russia's military intervention. 56% of French people. And I'm talking, you know, that is at the height of the hysteria. You know, he's invading a country, he's breaking the law, you know, poor defenseless, peace-minding democracy, Ukraine. 56% of French people nevertheless said that they believed at least one of Vladimir Putin's rationales for launching the special military operation. So, you know, the relationship goes back centuries. It has had its low points, but it has also had its high points. I think that the French people remember that after Alexander II defeated Napoleon, or was it Alexander I? I don't know. There's too many Alexanders in this story. He came to Paris and he did not ransack Paris. They came in and then they left. So he showed deep respect towards French civilization. So there is, you know, like there is a certain affinity there, which is, you know, which has been propagandized against for a very long time, but it's nevertheless there. And then among the French people, unlike German people, there is still very strong national pride and equally strong dislike for the European Union. You know, the French have had it with the European Union. So I think that France could turn out to be perhaps one of the big, powerful founding nations of the European Union, who are going to be the first to start thinking about their own national interests. And, you know, Macron might not be that man, but things change in politics. You know, Saudi Prince MBS was a different person when he took power than he is today. The change in his inclination has been almost, what did Annalena Baerbock say, 360 degrees?
These are the geniuses running Europe.
It's been practically
360 degree about turn.
Yes. No, but you know, MBS has made a practically 180 degree turn, which he can because he's the sovereign. Macron cannot do it. But nevertheless, you know, there is this political process in France. There is grassroots pressure, which is strong in France. You know, the French don't suffer nonsense lightly. And so I think that at the end of the day, both Macron and the French elites have to take that into account. They cannot completely ignore it. And, you know, on the other side, because, you know, again, it's the fracture is between two systems of governance, one which is represented by the effectively Anglo-American elites, and the other one, which is everybody else, including the middle and lower class French. So I think that this is a change that is probably coming, and we're going to see the ripple effect. And who knows, you know, there's going to be another long conversation between Vladimir Putin and Emmanuel Macron. Who knows? It might be going on as we speak now. And the effects are going to be felt in one way or another over the coming months.
Alex?
No, the term sovereign, I think, is the key term, and Putin has said it in many statements. He has no time to waste in negotiating with EU leaders. No time to waste in negotiating with Ukraine, obviously, because Ukraine is not a sovereign state. This is according to many statements from high-level Russian officials, including Vladimir Putin. There's no reason to speak with Zelensky because Zelensky doesn't make the decisions. He now says this openly about the European Union leaders as well. There's no need to discuss anything with Germany or France or Italy or the EU Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, or anybody, because they're not making decisions either. So he always says, if there's anybody that we'll talk to is the United States, unless someone like Macron decides to act as a sovereign leader. I think that's the key. And so we have to see, for me, we have to see an EU nation outside of Hungary and Orban, but you're talking about a very small country, but you have to see one of the big players in the EU, Germany, France, maybe Italy, you could say Italy, maybe you could say Spain or the Netherlands or something. But I mean, really, you're talking about Italy and France. I mean, those are the two big countries, the foundations of the European Union. You have to see one of these countries come out and show that they are a sovereign. You know, MBS, going back to MBS, I mean, Saudi Arabia and the U.S. were tied together with the USD, with the petrodollar. I mean, everyone thought, you know, that there would never be a break in this relationship. It was impossible. But, you know, the Biden White House, they tried to screw over Saudi Arabia. And they tried to take away Saudi Arabia's what makes Saudi Arabia Saudi Arabia, which is the oil and OPEC. And they tried to dictate the price of oil to OPEC and to Saudi Arabia with the oil price caps. And that's what really pissed off Saudi Arabia. They said, wait a minute. You're trying to take away the one thing that is critical for our very existence. You're trying to take away this power from us under the guise of price caps and all of these sanctions on Russia. And Saudi Arabia said, we're not going to have any of it. I think that was the big shift for Saudi Arabia. Macron was in a kind of similar position a while back with the AUKUS submarine deal, and he balked. The U.S. screwed him. The U.S. screwed him bad on AUKUS, and he crawled back to the U.S. So, but the scale of OPEC, of what the U.S. tried to do to OPEC and MBS, I think was much greater than the AUKUS deal. But still, if something like that happens again with France, if the U.S. goes to screw over France again, which they will, then we're going to see if Macron, whoever's president, has the guts to say, this time, enough, where we are breaking rank, and we're going to start to look after our own sovereignty. Once they look after their own sovereignty, I think the whole world is open to doing all kinds of business. And if there's anything that the sanctions against Russia has taught us, is that it's a big world out there, and there's a lot of countries that are ready to make deals.
Yep. Ali, something is going back to Alex Christoforou, what you said at the beginning about Putin, that we'll talk to whoever's in charge, whoever's sovereign. And then Alex Kroner, this is something that you and Tom have alluded to. And I don't fully understand. I'm not fully on board, but I'm not saying it's not the case either. I just don't know. If it's not Davos, the WEF running the show, then the other people running the show are the British imperial elite with their, you know, with their pies in everything. Was it the Crown owned 25% of Canada, Canadian territory? And they must own vast swathes of land in their former colonies, other former colonies as well. But, and Putin has said about the Anglo-Saxons, referring to the Anglo-Saxons. So is it, do you think, Alex Risfer, that the British elite in the shadows, pulling strings?
I don't know. This I don't, you know, I think about this. Is it the British that are pulling the strings in the U.S. or is it the U.S. that is pulling the strings in the U.K. Because the this powerful British elite moved from London to New York and to Wall Street. This I don't know. I mean you're talking about. I think we're probably dealing more with a globalist class now. I think we're dealing with an elite, a British elite that once upon a time would have said they're the British elite. They're the city of London, but now I think these people are more the globalist class. But I think they're based in, for the most part, in the U.S. because that's where they can project the most power, is via the White House and via the U.S. and via the U.S. military. So I think that's why when someone like Putin says, "I'm going to speak to the White House, to the U.S.," whether he's talking about Biden or the British elite that run the U.S. but are based mostly out of Wall Street, or the globalist crowd like the Klaus Schwabs that could be based in Switzerland and Davos. But once again, most of their stuff is run out of Wall Street. At the end of the day, I think the globalist power center is the United States and Wall Street. That's what I feel. Washington, D.C., Wall Street, that entire area, I think, is where the real globalist power base is. Okay. And those are the people that are controlling the power projection that the U.S. wields, which is the military, the aircraft carriers, all these things.
Okay. Alex Kroner?
Yeah, that's, you know, the reason why that's difficult to know is because it's essentially unknowable. At that level, people do not leave much paper trail, and they literally go to meetings without any papers, without any documents, everything's shredded. But, you know, if you observe very carefully the people in power in the United States, and it's not just one faction in power, there's more than one faction vying for power in the United States. And the people who are on the side of Trump are definitely not on board with, you know, Davos, London crowd. However, if you look at the neocons, the people who staff Department of Defense, the Treasury Department, National Security Council, places like this.
State Department.
The State Department. You see that many, many of them are like Rhodes Scholars, people who spent a year or two in Cambridge or in Oxford mostly. People among military generals, you'll notice there are people whose children have some cushy sinecure in like a London law firm or some London PR firm. So these connections are very, very many. And then if you look at the conduct of foreign policy, in many cases, you see that London front runs the strategy. They take action first. You know, the Americans follow. And I see the special relationship a little bit like, for people who are old enough to remember Mad Max 3, there's the Master Blaster combo where you have like a strong muscular giant who on his back carries a little decrepit, midget. Dwarf,
yeah,
who is old, but he practically directs the blaster to do what the blaster is doing, and the blaster doesn't know why he's doing it, but the little dwarf on his back does. So I see it that way. And you know, when Alex is right that the center of power is the United States, financial it's in New York, diplomatic and military is it's in Washington, it's in Langley and so forth. But I think that still ideological and strategic headquarters is still the City of London. That's where most insiders, even in the U.S. elite, that's where they that's the altar where they pray.
Okay.
Yeah, look at just a final point on that. Look at Russiagate, the whole Trump Russiagate thing. I mean, exactly. That was the U.S. and the U.K. That was London. That was Oxford. I think it was Oxford or Cambridge. But I mean, that was the U.S. spies, the helpers, teaching at a university in Oxford, and they were the ones that were entrapping Papadopoulos and Professor Mifsud, who was in London. And yeah, then all the information exactly. was laundered out of London back to the U.S. I mean, the whole thing was a ping pong. PSYOP yeah. match between London and DC, and it was all being done to bring down Trump.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, another thing that's a telltale is the way the media treated this, because as the story developed, one after another of these names, Joseph Mifsud, Sir Richard Dearlove, and all of these Brits with ties to MI6 started to emerge. In the media, it would never be mentioned that they're British. It would always, I remember Sean Hannity, practically the only anchor who covered this story correctly, more or less. He would always rail, practically every night, he would rail against Russian lies, Russian propaganda. He would repeat those sound bites several times every evening. But every time he referred to the dossier, he would say, dossier drafted by foreign nationals. And so, you know, when you say that in one sentence, Russian lies, Russian propaganda with a dossier drafted by foreign nationals, you think like, ah, duh, the Russians, right?
But it yeah, was first is British propaganda.
Yeah, exactly. Christopher Steele. It's never mentioned, you know? Yeah. And how can that be? There's got to be some fatwa there that says thou shalt not mention the Brits.
Yeah. Where does a guy like Christopher Steele, where does he end up being the guy that gets a dossier put together about Trump and a peeing escapade in Moscow, this former MI6 or whatever he was, MI6 agent, and now he was working at a think tank in London, and all of a sudden he's the person that's bringing down the president of the United States with a dossier that no one wanted to touch for over a year, and all of a sudden BuzzFeed News is publishing this dossier. The whole thing was being run out of London.
Out of London,
the entire yeah. operation, but it was being filtered back to the United States.
Yeah, and also the Magnitsky Act 2012. So Magnitsky Act was again a London operation, because it was all lobbied through U.S. Congress by Bill Browder, who is a British subject. He used to be American, but he sits in London. His business partner is HSBC Bank. And I don't know, people say he's CIA, but I think he's probably as likely to be MI6 as he is the CIA. At any rate, he's in London. He was one of the people on that integrity initiative, where they had this very secretive propaganda think tank, which was tasked with producing materials to offset Russian malign influence in Europe. So Bill Browder was part of that. It was all, you know, London manufacturers of propaganda that then filtered through to the United States. But obviously, United Kingdom, you know, the little decrepit dwarf cannot do much. It needs to convince the big blaster guy, which is the United States. So, you know, where do they go to lobby Magnitsky Act through? In the United States. And the reason why, you know, for the benefit of your viewers, Magnitsky Act is not a household name, but it was passed in U.S. Congress in 2012, ostensibly as a human rights legislation, but it's deemed as the opening salvo of the new Cold War between the United States and Russia.
And what did it do, just again, for viewers that don't know, including myself, right, in a nutshell?
So it was, okay, ostensibly, it was supposed to punish Russian entities, individuals or companies, who were accused on infringing human rights. Because you know how we care about human rights in the West. You know, that's we deeply care about human rights, particularly of Russian people. We just love Russian human rights. But in reality, what it was like a moat around Western jurisdictions. It was passed in, I think, 36 countries since 2012. And it creates a moat around Western jurisdictions so that the Russians cannot bring court cases. They cannot. Okay, so the Russian transition from communism to capitalism in the 1990s was a massive industrial scale pirate raid on Russia by Western financial interests. They took away hundreds of billions of dollars of stolen goods, hundreds of works of art stolen straight from the museums, gold bars, weaponry, you name it. For 10 years, this was just a massive conveyor belt of Russian wealth that was going westward. And Russian police and intelligence services have literally hundreds of investigative dossiers with which to pursue the return of their goods, okay? And so what do? You have to go to the jurisdictions through which this was laundered, like Cyprus, London, Geneva, Zurich, New York, Bahamas, and so forth. And so what happens? You hire lawyers there. You send them your evidence. These lawyers file a case. Then they depose witnesses and maybe defendants. And then all of this goes on the record. And you can't expunge it from there. Once it's on the record, it's on the record. And then the judicial system takes its own inertia, because now you have a court case. Now you have your lawyers pursuing this case, filing documents with the judges. And so now you're going to get a lot of testimonies on record. And I think that ultimately, this is not stated anywhere, but I mean, the logic of the case kind of dictates that you have to trace these goods to their ultimate beneficial owners. So the people who conducted the pirate raid are the people who benefited the most from them. So under the guise of protecting human rights, they created this blockade where Russians can no longer access Western judicial system.
Right.
Okay.
They're stolen goods.
And how? It's very trivial how, because people who would travel from Russia to London and Zurich and Geneva, they go boom on a Magnitsky list, and then all their money is frozen. They cannot pay the lawyers anymore. They cannot make transfers anymore. They cannot have all their assets in the West get frozen, and so you kind of paralyze their action, and you can't smuggle yourself over the border with a suitcase full of cash. You'd end up in prison, right? So that basically shuts the door, right, to Russians pursuing their interest in the West.
Okay, thank you for that, Alex. Okay, now taking it back then to Europe. I know, actually, I want to say something. Alex, Cristofori, you and Alexander did incredible coverage on Russiagate, incredible coverage and analysis on Russiagate, and you called it, you and many other commentators, but your analysis that both of you do is just excellent. So I do recommend people go check out the Duran, and the link's in the description below.
I second that. I'm on Duran practically every day.
I listen to their stuff at high speed so I can take more in, right? And especially when they churn out their long videos, right? And then they do several videos over the weekend. I have to listen at high speed so I can get them in, right? I want to stay informed. Okay. And Alex Rainer, I have said to Alex Cristofori, he needs to get a hobby. He needs to get a hobby. He works too much.
you think he doesn't have enough to do? I don't even know how he manages to produce as much stuff as they do, but I do definitely appreciate it, because it's one of those little beacons that helps you make sense of everything.
Yeah, and also incredibly balanced. And one of the things that both Alexander and Alex do is they distinguish opinion from fact. This is my opinion, not a fact, which is really rare, certainly in the mainstream media.
Yeah, well, the mainstream media has become all punditry, all opinion.
With no basis in fact. Yeah. Okay, so let's go to, I'd like to go to the Netherlands. I don't know if any of you have anything to say about the Netherlands. Actually, before I do that, because France, Macron has signed a bill that would restrict immigration and make it easier to send people back. And in the Netherlands, we have Geert Wilders and his party as the largest party. I don't know if they've formed a government yet, but it is on this crest of the numbers of immigrants coming in, migrants. Now, I want to say for people watching, right, I'm first generation. I was born in Pakistan. and I came to the UK when I was 5 years old. So I'm an immigrant, but you can't accuse me of being xenophobic or anti-immigration in any way. What I do know is that open borders didn't serve the Native Americans. They couldn't control who was coming in. Open borders didn't serve the Tasmanian Aborigines, who, when the British arrived, they hunted every single one of them down like they were animals and killed them. So I'm not in favor of open borders. I want European culture and traditions to be preserved because they're as valid and valuable as any other. It's one thing to invite people in because your economy is expanding. There's something else to let anybody come in willy-nilly without any checks whatsoever and then compete with local people for resources, like what's happening in Ireland. Because I do cover what's happening in Ireland. It's like 20% of the population in Ireland is migrant now, and a formerly homogenous nation.
Oh. Hey, but look at the economic growth. Isn't that what they promised? Oh, you know, the problem is that they've been pitching this story about allowing large numbers of migrants, like it's a good thing for the economy. But they've been pitching that for more than 20 years now.
Yeah.
And where is all this incredible prosperity? Obviously, the effect is the opposite. And obviously, people have had enough now. But I think, you know, migrants are here. You can't easily get rid of them. It's a big problem. It's a big problem. And they started coming into Croatia as well. Maybe not in such large numbers because, you know, in Croatia, there's also language barriers. You know, many more people speak English or French or even Italian than speak Croatian. So it's more difficult for them to integrate there. And then we also have a crappy economy. So there's, you know, it's not a choice destination. But, you know, people started wondering, what the hell? What are we doing here? And how do you fix that problem? And I don't think there's an easy way to fix that problem, but I think that there's a risk of clash between, you know, locals and the immigrants. And this happens at small scale, but what if it grows to a large scale? And I think that a strategy worth considering would be for civic leaders at home to identify the leaders or the more charismatic people among the immigrants and to open channels of communication to talk to them, to get to know each other, and to finally come out in, to say, look, they're setting us up for a clash. It's going to be a lot of pain on both sides. Let's not play into their hands. And, you know, let's inform each other.
Sure. But Alice, that takes leadership. And there is no leadership. And forget about Netherlands, because Tusk is now in charge in Poland. And Poland is now going to be...
I didn't mean the leadership as in our, you know, Ursula von der Leyen type, you know, or you know, Justin Trudeau or people like that. I mean, like, people, like police captains.
Right.
People in the civil defense. You know, lower ranked, you know, local commanders of military units or civil defense, whatever you have. But they have to know where this is going on, where the flashpoints are. They need to develop strategies for diffusing these flashpoints. They need to have a way to reach out to individuals in these detention camps who might be called on to stage provocations. I think it's worth a consideration at the very least, because otherwise, you know, you have that story of black ants and red ants, and somebody shakes up the jar and everybody starts killing each other.
Yeah. Alex Christopher?
No, I mean, for the EU, for Europe, I mean, the immigration is baked in the cake. I mean, it's what the EU is about. So I think you're not going to solve the EU issue on a country level, the immigration issue on a country level until the EU breaks apart. And then every country is going to have to start to look after its own borders. I mean, I think right there, at least as far as Europe is concerned, the EU is concerned, you know, once you have the free movement and someone like Angela Merkel opens up the doors to immigration, that's it. I mean, it's, you know, the immigration is going to pass through all of Europe. And that's exactly what Merkel did in 2015. But, you know, why did she do that? Well, one of the reasons that all that happened is because of the chaos that they unleashed in Syria. Hmm. And when I mean they, I mean the West, collective West, the UK, France, the US, Assad must go. and they unleashed chaos in Syria. And with the immigration from Syria came immigrants from all over, because it's, you know, if you have a large population from one country immigrating into another area, into another region, you're going to have other countries who are going to piggyback off of that, and other immigrants who are going to piggyback off of that, and they're going to also come in. But until the EU breaks apart and each country has to then look after its own interests, that's when I think you're going to see change happen with regards to immigration. But going deeper into it, the conflicts have to end. Libya, Syria, you know, everything that Obama was doing in Somalia, he was bombing Somalia. I mean, you know, if you look at the last 10 years, Iraq, you look at the last 10 years, 15 years, I mean, you know, the collective West, they've completely demolished the Middle East and North Africa. They completely demolished it. Mm. And so, yeah, I think we are seeing this starting to change. And we talked about Saudi Arabia, but we are seeing a Middle East, and we are starting to see a North Africa starting to feel confident in their own sovereignty, their own statehood, their own identity, their own cultures. You're starting to see that develop now. I think we're at a very, very early stage, very, very early stage. But a country like Saudi Arabia, a country like the UAE, Iran, you are starting to see countries now starting to say, you know, we can operate independent of the collective West, and we can defend ourselves. And a lot of that is due to the fact that all of these countries now have a choice. You know, 15 years ago, 5 years ago, you didn't have a binary. It was one player. That was the U.S. That was the West. You wanted financing? IMF, World Bank. You wanted military protection? You wanted weapons? United States. But now they have a choice. Anything that the U.S. can give to Saudi Arabia, BRICS, China, Russia can also give to Saudi Arabia. You want a market? We got the biggest one in China. You want goods, manufactured goods? Well, China is the heart of of manufacturing. It's the engine of the entire world.
Yeah, you want nuclear power stations?
You want nuclear power? Yeah. Go to Russia. Everyone's the myth that Russia makes nothing. Russia is a gas station masquerading as a country. It's nonsense.
Yeah.
Russia makes all kinds of things, but Russia makes big things. Russia's very good at making very big things. They're not going to make the little small stuff. That stuff, go to China for that stuff. But look at cars now, automobiles. What's the country that's number one in automobile manufacturing now? I mean, it's or has surpassed Germany. China surpassed Germany. So I think a lot of countries where you saw immigration leaving those countries and heading into Europe, I think over the next 10, 20, 30 years, I think a lot of these countries are going to start to emerge as more confident nations, because they're confident in the fact that they now have options where they didn't have options before. They now have options, and they could build their country based on those options. They could have China come in and build roads or railways or an airport. They don't have to go to the U.S. and they don't have to deal with the U.S. because with the U.S. comes all kinds of restrictions and strings attached and lecturing about values and democracy and all of these things that they lecture a country on. And you have to, this NGO has to, you have to, you know, open up an NGO here and a university there, an American university, an American NGO, and we're going to lecture you on how to be a good person and how to have values. And then we'll build your road, or we'll give you this financing. China comes in there, they don't care. Can we do business? It's great. Let's do business. So immigration's tough. That's a tough issue. But, you know, my take on immigration, at least with regards to Europe, has always been the EU, once it breaks apart, then countries are going to really have to start thinking about protecting their national interests and their borders. And the whole BRICS multipolar dynamic is going to change a lot of the world, a lot of the global South.
Okay, so when is the EU going to break apart? And what will it look like? And why will it break apart? For anybody watching who's still a Europhile or a Remainer, which I certainly am not, I would still vote Brexit. If there was a vote tomorrow, I would still
vote Brexit. You know, why did, going back to the whole London-US thing, why did everyone freak out? Why did the globalists freak out so much? Why do they want to censor everybody? Why do they want to control everybody? Why do they hate Trump so much? Why do they want to micromanage the entire world and control everything? Because of the two big events, Brexit and Trump. Somehow Brexit slipped through the cracks, and somehow Trump slipped through the cracks, and they freaked out, and now they want to control everything. And so once again, you go back to that dynamic of the US and the UK, because the big events that really flipped out the globalists were the events that took place in the UK and the events that took place in the US, which they weren't expecting.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So how's it going to roll out in Europe over the next few years then, in general, generally?
I personally think that Europe is already in the process of coming apart. Because, you know, Europe has some very bossy, tight rules about how countries must unquestionably harmonize their laws with the EC, European Commission's directives. You know, no questions asked, you just do. And already countries are not doing that. You know, they're already beginning to do their own thing and disregard the EC law. So you have then these huge problems with countries like Hungary and Poland. And okay,
so hold on, Hungary I get, right? But Poland's now turning because Tusk is in charge. Although I don't know how probably beginning to be very fragile. But if you can give examples, what are the other countries that are like, no, 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 we're going to go our own way?
Hungary.
There are more. There's which Slovenia is playing it carefully between Russia and the EU.
Yes, Bulgaria. But I think that the you know, these things start to fall out of whack gradually in small ways. Mm. But then there's going to be a catalyzing event where it's going to start to come apart in big ways. And I think that the catalyzing event is going to be the final defeat of Ukraine. And I don't know when that's going to happen, because we don't know yet where Russia is going to go. But there's reason to believe that Russia will take most of eastern Ukraine, and that it's going to take all of the Black Sea coast. Okay, when that happens, here's the first problem you have. Ukraine is left basically as an agricultural resource producer, as an agricultural commodity producer. They lose access to the Black Sea, or they can only go there on terms that Russia agrees to. All that grain, there's going to be pressure building on Poland and Hungary and all the Eastern European countries to buy Ukraine's grain. You can predict that European Commission will insist that we support Ukraine by opening our markets to them, which will be absolutely devastating to the agricultural sectors of all those countries, because Ukrainians are going to be dumping massive quantities of agricultural products into Europe, or they will want to, or they will try to. And so at that point, you can expect social uprisings in those countries, and the governments are not going, you know, it's just going to be a rerun of what we've already seen, but probably in a bigger way. And the clash, positions are going to become irreconcilable. And then we're going to have, you know, a political faction emerge that goes for Poland exit and Hungary exit and so forth, which will gain some really strong grassroots support. And then what do? Well, you kill them all, it just goes away, it falls apart. And I think that then you have this inertia where, you know, these ossified structures cannot just disband from one day to the next, that everybody says like, but okay, it didn't work out, everybody, you know, pack up your desk and go home. It's probably going to drag on for some years. They're going to flail around to try a way to be relevant. They might close themselves into the, you know, the core of the European Union, the you know, the founding members. But then, you know, what if the relationship between France and Russia develops in a way that France starts breaking ranks? So I don't know. I think it's very, very difficult to predict. I think it's definitely going to take years to unravel. But we're already going in that direction. You know, it's the ship is already going in the wrong direction, and it's not going to turn around. And then, sorry, just to add one extra Trump card into this whole thing, Europe is going also in the direction of hyperinflation. And so, if the currency collapses, then you know, that's another element that's going to accelerate the collapse of the whole union.
Okay. The hyperinflation conversation I haven't heard in Europe. I know it's coming, but the way you said it sounds like there's some imminent.
Like I know things, right?
Yeah, like what you can't just throw that in towards the end. Oh, and this big deal, right? I'm going to come back to you, Alex. Alex, do you want to say anything about what Ukraine don't about the about Ukraine and when the UK EU will crumble? And then if you want to say something about hyperinflation.
No, I completely agree. I mean, 100%, it's baked in the cake. The EU is done. Now, what that means is it's hard to predict when and what it means, what the EU is going to actually be. You could be looking at an EU in 10 years, which is just the core states. You could be looking at something like Netherlands, Germany, maybe not even France. Maybe you could be looking at Netherlands, Germany, Poland, or something like that, which could represent the EU. Maybe it'll go back to the original countries. Maybe you have two tiers of EU. I mean, I think Alex is 100% right. They'll try to figure out ways to kick the can down the road as long as they can, because that's what the EU does best.
Yep.
The EU is great at kicking the can down the road. They know how to do that. And so that's what they're going to do. But, you know, I've been saying it for a while now. The EU decided that Ukraine was going to be the hill that it was going to die on. And the Russians made sure that, actually, I won't even say the Russians, the EU, with their stupid decisions, made sure that Ukraine was going to be the hill that they were going to die on, because the Russians really didn't even do much. It was the Europeans decided to get rid of their entire hinterland, all their resources, all the cheap gas, all the cheap commodities. They're the ones that cut it off. And yep. So they effectively, they took the sword to themselves. You know, they're that Roman soldier who just put the sword and just, you know, plopped down on it. So, you know, yeah, Alex is 100% right. That's a decision they made. You could say the U.S. pushed them, the U.S. coerced them, the U.S. forced them. But look, these are grown men, women, people. And they decided that they're going to follow Biden down this adventure, this Ukraine adventure. And so be it. So when is it going to happen? I don't know. Could take 5 years, could take 10 years. But I think you're going to see, like Alex said, you're going to see them trying to say, okay, well, today the EU is going to change to a two-tier system or three-tier system. And we're going to have the core countries be this and the non-core countries be that. Who knows? They'll try to figure out ways to kick the can down the road, but it's done. And just one final point before you ask Alex about the hyperinflation part. No one is taking Europe seriously anymore. Look at the conflict in Israel and in Gaza, the war there. No one even cares about the EU's opinion. No one talks to the EU. No one listens to the EU with regards to the conflict in Israel. They're a non-entity. The US doesn't deal with them. Even the conflict in Ukraine, Putin is like, I don't even care what the EU thinks or what they say. The person I'm dealing with is the person in the White House. So the EU has already been marginalized to a great extent. They've been isolated. Jungle Joseph, the garden and the jungle. The garden is isolated. Yeah. So anyway, yeah.
Alex Craner, hyperinflation.
Yeah, before I tackle hyperinflation, I
don't you start putting something else in.
Sorry?
Don't you start putting something else in.
No, I just wanted to say that Europe does have one thing going for it. And that is when you think that everything is going the wrong way, you get that Ursula von der Leyen delivers one of her inspirational, galvanizing speech that draws the defeat out of the victory out of jaws of defeat.
She has found
joking,
European
obviously.
Values. European values. Europe
it's absolutely
does have its
ridiculous.
Values.
But you know what Alex was saying is absolutely spot on, and you could also see that when Macron went to China, and Ursula also went to China, and Macron was treated like an honored guest, and Ursula had to go through the regular check-in at the checkout at the airport to board her plane. It was completely like, yeah, whatever. They treated her like a tourist there, you know, like, hey, you know.
Remember when Erdogan had the seat? He had one chair. for Michelle and Ursula. And yeah. Michelle sat and Ursula was like, hey, where do I sit?
Yeah, exactly. So you can see that. You can see that it's not going places. Okay, so hyperinflation. So basically, you know, our monetary systems in the West, not just the EU, but practically worldwide, are inverted pyramids where, you know, the tip of the pyramid is the healthy collateral. And then the big pyramid that grows by accretion on top is credit that's growing still, but the collateral is shrinking. Okay. And so you have a mounting bad debts on the books of European banks. But this is true for the United States as well, but the European banks are far more leveraged and far more vulnerable than the American banks. And, you know, this could lead to a complete collapse from one day to the next. Now, this hasn't happened, even though large European banks like Deutsche Bank, UBS, Credit Suisse, RBS, Santander, they've been on the death watch for
years.
At the very least since 2016, that everybody in the industry was going, there's going to be a banking crisis. It could happen any day now, but it isn't happening. That's amazing, isn't it? Even though we even had the COVID crisis, which should have wiped out the banking industry, and it didn't happen. Why? Because the bankers actually staged a coup. They staged a coup, and they are running the show. And the way, one of the things that they're doing is that they are simply issuing any amount of currency that they need to patch up all the bad debts. How do they do that? They do that by buying bonds of the companies that should otherwise go bankrupt. But you buy bond of the company, you effectively loan them money, right? And then with that money, they can continue to finance themselves and keep in operation, even though, you know, this is Soviet level of market manipulation. And there's no improving the situation, not only, but in indirect ways, France's colonial possessions were part of that healthy collateral. Well, they lost it. So now, you know, you only have one tool really to stave off collapse, and that is printing money. Okay? Well, if you continue to print money, eventually that money becomes worthless. And so you start having rising commodity prices. You start having rising labor costs because people can't meet their, you know, that people collectively, everybody has too much month at the end of their money. And so they need to press for raises, for higher. So there's going to be strikes, but, you know, what do? You have to give in some way. Otherwise, your whole society crumbles to pieces and you can't put everybody in prison. And so this is coming. You know, unfortunately, with inflations, it is impossible to predict things. You know, we already had one wave of inflation, which has now come down because they've been all tightening the money supply and the interest rates. But, you know, if you look at the history of inflation in the 1940s and early 1950s in the United States, and the inflation in 1970s, both cases, the inflation unraveled in three waves. So you had the initial wave, it comes right down almost, you know, to normal levels. Then it takes off, goes a little bit higher. It comes down again, and then it goes up again. So it's three waves, but you have maybe 10, 15 years of double-digit inflation. And that's if we're lucky, if they manage it well. If they don't manage it well, inflation can take off like this, and it can just accelerate gradually into hyperinflation, where you have, you know, Zimbabwe or Argentina-style inflation. You start having 100% inflation a month. Well, that's coming because Europe doesn't have a plan B. That's literally the only tool. You would have to enslave people, or you would have to conquer new colonial possessions to, you know, to extract collateral. So that you can you can put something firm to stabilize this inverted pyramid, but we don't we this isn't even within the realm of possibility. So all that's left is printing money. And I lived through that. And, you know, it doesn't feel like anything until it starts to feel like it starts to bite. And then it only goes higher and higher and higher and higher and higher. And gosh, you know, in the case of former Yugoslavia, it ended in a war. And in Europe, 100% it's going to end in social uprisings, which could be, I don't know, you know, some of the events that are happening now are disconcertingly similar to events that led into the French Revolution. You know, and that left like 30,000 chopped heads and a complete devastation of the country. And so I think we have to be extremely careful, and I think we have to be extremely vigilant, and we have to really, really pay attention to what's going on and hope and pray that we can put forward leaders who are going to know how to put the brakes on this system.
Right. Alex, thank you. Thank you. Alex Christopher, anything to add before we finish up?
I would just say that what Alex said is true and interesting, but don't discount the EU trying to enslave people. They are trying to give that a shot.
That is true.
You joke, but no, here's what happened.
I laugh out of tongue-in-cheek in a way, but yeah, they are
Alex,
trying.
Alex, you're joking, but this is they're actually working on that. You know, I don't know if they'll be able to pull it off, but they are working on that. Yeah. You know, with the digital ID and everything, I've already had twice in the past 2 weeks clients tell me, oh my gosh, you know, right after I paid your invoice, I got a call from my bank and like a whole interrogation. But they asked me like, what is this bill? I went, we're not talking millions of dollars. We're talking about a couple of hundred or a couple of thousand. They asked them like, what is this for? Who is this that you're paying? What is the service that you're getting? And then they say, all right, thank you. We will investigate. This is the bank I'm talking about, not the police, not the tax authority. This is the bank that is turning itself into Gestapo. Mm. Once they have a hold of your money, that's the mechanism of enslavement. So when they start telling you this bill you can pay, this item you can purchase. And then last summer, I was going to Croatia on vacation, and I went to my bank. You know, back 20 years ago, you could walk into any bank in Monaco, you could take any amount of cash, any amount of money in cash, walk out of the bank, no questions asked. Okay, this was one of the things. Well, I had to go through an interrogation to get a couple of thousand euros in cash. And I said, you know, I wasn't particularly happy about that. And I said, so what are you going to do if I don't cooperate? And they said, we can close your bank account. And, you know, if they do that, then it's not like you can walk into the next bank and open a bank account. Mm. Because they all share a database of deplorables. And so probably every bank in France is going to give you the same answer. They're going to say no. And at that point, you have fallen through the cracks of the system. You can't pay health insurance. You can't have, you know, how do you get a job? How do you get paid your salary? So the fact that they're already doing this means that they are building the mechanisms of enslavement. They are. And for anybody who thinks that this is conspiracy theory, it's a conspiracy analysis. And you can read many think tank policy paper where these things are, you know, cryptically discussed. And in some of them, they're discussed very openly. Yeah. Where they say, like, we need a 21st century version of enslavement to keep control of a society, flat out like that.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, we have to. The cost of liberty is eternal vigilance. And so I would just encourage everybody to just switch on their vigilance circuit board from this day on, if they haven't already.
Yes. And Ali, just say that I don't think CBDCs will be successful.
They
won't.
No, I don't think. No.
They won't last. They're going to do a lot of mess. And what we have as an alternative are decentralized structures, decentralized money, decentralized VPNs, decentralized media platforms such as ThreeSpeak and Odyssey, and decentralized independent media outlets such as Alex Christoforou and Alexander Mercurius of The Durant and Alex Craner of Naked Hedgie. Guys, do you want to say where people can find you?
Yeah, I'm easy to find on Twitter, on X. My handle is at Naked Hedgie, and I have a Substack, Alex Craner's Trend Compass.
Yeah, and I'll have those links in the description below. And Alex Christoforou?
You can find us, the best place to find us is theduran.locals.com, and you can also find us on pretty much every major platform, from YouTube to Twitter to Rumble, yeah. Odyssey, BitChute, Telegram.
Are you still on platforms?
And Rockfin as well.
Rockfin,
yes.
And Rumble. And okay.
Yes, so we're on all the platforms, yeah.
You might want to get on.
Oh, and by the way, Alex, I find it very clever how you guys are managing to keep yourself ditching the axe of the censors, because you guys give really good analysis, really good coverage. But I think it's in a way that, you know, they don't give reasons to somebody to come down hard on them. So,
gosh, I don't know about that. Whenever people say that to me, I get very nervous. But I'm knocking on wood right now. But to be honest, we don't think about that. We just have a conversation.
You do.
That's the honest truth.
Quality conversation. Yeah. I've learned so much from both of you, and also from you, Alex. And look forward to having both of you back on again. For anybody who's watching, please subscribe. Check these guys out, their channels and everything. And between now and when I see you next, please keep filling your pockets with freedom and decentralization. This is Crypto Rich and Crypto Alex signing out. All the best. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Bye.